The harbour master took only a glance at the military travel pass before he assigned Penrod to the gang of stevedores on the next ammunition ship to leave for the south. Penrod wondered again if the elaborate precautions he was taking to avoid recognition were truly necessary. Then he reminded himself that the owner of almost every black or brown face in the swarming docks was a sympathizer of the dervish. He knew also that he was a marked man. His heroics at El Obeid had been widely discussed, for they were the one blemish on a perfect victory for the Mahdi and his Khalifa. Bakita had warned him that when his name was uttered in the souks along the riverfront, it was with a frown and a curse. The steamer's cargo was made up entirely of military stores for the army, which was assembling at Wadi Halfa in preparation for the drive upriver. The loading continued all that night and most of the next day. It had been a long time since Penrod had indulged in such hard and debilitating labour. A pause to straighten an aching back, or even the slightest hesitation, invited the flick and snap of the kerbash whip from one of the overseers. It required all his self-restraint to grovel to the blows and not retaliate with a clenched fist. The ship settled lower into the water as the heavy ammunition cases were heaped on her decks. At sunrise, as she left the wharf, pulled into the channel of the river, and thrust her ugly round bows into the current, she had less than 2 feet of freeboard. Penrod found a space between the tall piles of crates and stretched out in it. He clasped his skinned knuckles and raw fingers under his armpits. He ached in every joint and muscle. It was almost 20 hours steaming against the stream to the port of Wadi Halfa. He slept for most of the voyage and was fully recovered by the time they arrived early the next morning. 14 larger steamers were anchored in the main stream of the river. On the south bank was a vast encampment, lines of white canvas tents and mountainous piles of military stores. Boatloads of helmeted troops were being ferried out to the steamers by nagas and small dhows. Sir Evelyn Baring had explained the rescue expedition plan in detail. This was the river division of the double-pronged advance southwards. The flotilla was preparing to set out on the detour around the great western bend of the river. They would be forced to negotiate 3 dangerous cataracts along the way. The men going on board would have to tow the steamers on long lines from the bank through those boiling rock-strewn narrows. Ahead of them, the desert column would travel swiftly across the bend of the Nile to Matima, where Chinese Gordon's 4 little steamers were waiting to carry a small detachment of hand-picked men to Khartoum to reinforce the city until the arrival of the main relief column. The ammunition ship moored against the riverbank and the porters were immediately roused into beginning to offload. Penrod was one of the first ashore, and again his travel pass, when displayed to the subaltern in charge of the detail, worked its small miracle. He was allowed through. He picked his way through the encampment and was challenged often before he reached the guard post at the entrance to the zareba that contained the desert column. Its 4 regiments, commanded by General Sir Herbert Stewart, were drilling and exercising on the parade ground in preparation for the long trek across the loop. But it might be weeks or even months before they received the final marching orders from London. The sergeant of the guard must have been forewarned of Penrod's arrival, for he did not quibble when the dirty Arab labourer addressed him in the idiom of the officer's mess and demanded to be taken to the adjutant's tent.
"Ah, Ballantyne! I received the telegraph from Colonel Adams in Cairo, but I didn't expect you for 3 or 4 days yet. You've made good time."
Major Kenwick shook hands, but refrained from mentioning Penrod's unusual garb. Like most of the senior officers, he was rather fond of this young scamp, but a little envious of his escapades. He seemed to have a knack of popping up whenever the bullets were flying and promotion was in the air.
"Thank you, Major. Do you know by any chance if my men are here?"
"Yes, damn it. And that sergeant of yours has helped himself to 5 of my best camels. If I had not been firm, he would have made off with the whole troop."
"I'll be on my way, then, if you will excuse me, sir."
"So soon? I rather hope that we might have the pleasure of your company in the mess for dinner this evening."
Penrod saw that he was eaten up with curiosity about this mysterious visitation. "I'm in rather a hurry, sir."
"Perhaps we might see you in Khartoum, then.
the adjutant kept fishing resolutely.
"Oh, I doubt it, sir. Shall we agree to meet at the long bar of the Gazira Club when this little business has been settled?"
Sergeant Al-Sada was waiting for him at the Camel Lines. Many eyes were watching, so his greeting was cold and dismissive, a measure of the wide social chasm between a sergeant in a regiment of the Queen and a common fella. They rode into the dunes, Penrod trailing behind him on the grey she-camel. His spirits surged as she moved under him. He knew at once that Al-Sada had chosen a wind-eater for him. As soon as they were out of sight of the camp, Al-Sada reined in. As Penrod came up alongside him, his forbidding expression split in a flashing grin, and he snapped his clenched fist across his chest in the riding salute.
"I saw you on the deck of the steamer when she came round Ras Indira. You have travelled fast, Abadan Riji."
The name meant "the one who never turns back."
"I told Yakub you would be here in less than 5 days."
"Fast I came," Penrod agreed, "but even faster must we go." Yakub was waiting for them a mile further on. He had the other camels couched behind an outcrop of black rock. Their shapes were rendered grotesque by the water skins they carried, like huge black cancerous growths on their backs. Each camel was capable of carrying 500 pounds, but in the Mother of Stones desert, each man needed 2 gallons of water every day to stay alive. As they dismounted, Yakub hurried to greet Penrod. He went down on one knee and touched his lips and his heart.
"Faithful Yakub has waited for you since Kurban Barem."
"I see you, beloved of Allah," Penrod smiled back at him. "But did you forget my pack?" Yakub looked pained. He ran back, untied it from one of the camels, and brought it to him. Penrod unrolled it on the baked earth. He saw that his galabeah had been freshly laundered. Swiftly he changed his rags for the fine wool robe that would protect him from the sun. He covered his face with the black cotton headdress in the fashion of the Bedouin, and tied the black sash around his waist. He tucked the curved dagger and the Webley revolver into the sash over his right hip, and his cavalry sabre on the opposite hip to balance them. Then he drew the sabre from its plain leather scabbard and tested the edge. It stung like a cutthroat razor, and he nodded approval at Yakub. Then he made a few practice strokes with the steel, cutting to both sides, lunging high and low, recovering instantly. The sabre felt good in his hand and seemed to take on a life of its own. In this age of breech-loading rifles and heavy ordnance, Penrod still revelled in the arme blanche. Almost every Arab carried the long broadsword, and Penrod had observed their use of the blade in contrast to his own. The heavy weapon did not suit the Arab physique. Unlike the mailed crusaders from whom the heavy blade had been copied, they were not big, powerful men. They were terriers rather than mastiffs. They were devils to cut and lunge, and the broadsword could inflict a terrible wound. But they were slow to recover their blade. They did not understand the parry, and they used their round leather shield almost exclusively to defend themselves. Against a skilled swordsman, they were vulnerable to a feint high in the natural line. Their instinctive response was to lift the shield and to lose sight of the opponent's point, and they would not see the thrust that followed the feint like a thunderbolt. At El Obaid, when the square had broken and the dervish had swarmed in, Penrod had killed 5 in as many minutes with that ploy. He ran the blade back into its scabbard and asked Yakub, "Is the Mother of Stones open?"
"There is water at Marbad Tega," in the Tarka dialect. The well's name meant camel killer. "Little and bitter, but sufficient for the camels," Yakub replied.
Yakub was a Jailin Arab who had been driven from the tents of his people by a blood feud that started in a quarrel over dishonour to Yakub's sister. Yakub was quick and expert with the blade, and the man had died. However, he had been the son of a powerful sheikh. Yakub had been forced to flee for his life. One of Yakub's eyes gazed in a different direction from the other. The ringlets that dangled from under his turban were greasy, and his teeth, when he smiled at Penrod, were yellow and crooked. He knew and understood the desert and the mountains with the instinct of a wild ass, Before he had been driven out of the tribe, he had taken a knife wound that had left him with a limp. Because of this affliction, he had been refused service in the armies of the Queen and the Khedive. Thus, with no tribe and no other master, Penrod was all he had. Jacob loved him like a father and a god. "So, we can still cut the snake?" When Penrod posed a question of such weight, Jacob gave it all his respect and attention. He tucked the skirts of his galabeah between his legs and squatted. With his camel goad, he scratched a large figure S in the dirt. But the upper loop was smaller by half than the lower. It was a rough charting of the course of the Nile from where they stood to the mouth of the Shabluka Gorge. To follow the river bank through this serpentine meandering would add many weeks to the journey. This, of course, was the route that the flotilla of the River Division would be forced to take. The Desert Division, on their camels, would cut across the Great Loop and regain the river at Metemma. This short cut was well marked by the caravans of the ages and by the bleached bones they had left behind them. There were two wells along the way that gave the traveller just sufficient water to make the crossing. Once they reached Metemma, they could follow the upper limb of the Nile, keeping always in sight of the river as it swung back west again, until eventually it settled once more on its southerly course and headed for Khartoum. It was a hard road, but there was a harder one yet. The caravan masters called it cutting the snake. Jacob made a bold slash with the goad, drawing a straight line from their present position directly to the city of Khartoum. The line cut the S-bend of the river neatly in half. It saved hundreds of miles of bitter, grueling travel. But the trail was unmarked, and to take a wrong turning meant missing the single well of Mabad Tega, and finding instead a certain terrible death. The well lay deep in the furnace-hot belly of the Mother of Stones, and it was well hidden. It would be easy to pass it by 100 paces and never know it was there. The camels could drink the water, but its caustic salts would drive a man mad. Once they had watered the camels at Mabad Tega, it was still another 100 miles to the bank of the Nile at Korti, below the Fourth Cataract. Long before they reached the river, all the water in the skins would be finished. They might be 24 hours without a drop before they saw the Nile again, longer than that if the jinni of the desert were unkind to them. Once they reached the river bank, they must cross the river. At this point, the current was swift, the stream was a mile wide, and the camels were reluctant swimmers. But there was a ford known to few. Once they had crossed, drunk their fill, and recharged the water skins, they would be forced to leave the Nile again and face the Monasser Desert on the other bank, another 200 waterless miles. Jacob reiterated all this, drawing it all on the earth with his goad. Penrod listened without interruption. Although he had cut the snake 3 times before and won through to the river crossing at Korti, there was always something fresh to learn from Jacob. When he had explained it all, Jacob announced, "With the fearless and cunning Jacob to guide you, and angels to watch over you, perchance we may indeed cut the snake." Then he rocked back on his haunches and waited for Penrod to make the decision. Penrod had been considering the gamble while he was talking. He would never have attempted it without Jacob. With him in the lead, the gains in time and distance to reach Khartoum were worth the gamble, but there was another even more telling consideration. Bakita had told him that the Mahdi and his Khalifa were well aware of the British preparations to rescue Gordon. Their spies had kept them fully informed of the concentration of British regiments and the flotilla at Wadi Halfa. She said that the Mahdi had ordered 12 of the most important emirs to leave the siege of Khartoum and take their tribes northwards along the river to contest the way, to meet the enemies at Metemma, Abu Klea, and Abu Hamed. She said that already both banks of the river from Khartoum down to the first great bend were swarming with Arab horsemen and camel troops. "The Mahdi knows that he must stop the Franks before they reach the city." She used the word that described all Europeans. "He knows that their army is small and poorly equipped with horses and camels. They say he has sent 20,000 men northwards to meet the British and to hold the river line until Low Nile, when he can complete the destruction of Khartoum and send General Gordon's head to his queen. She added, "Be careful, dear lord. They have cut the telegraph lines to the north, and they know that the generals in Cairo must send messengers to Khartoum to keep in contact with the general. The Mahdi will be expecting you to try to win through to the city. His men will be waiting to intercept you."
"Yes, they will be looking for us to cross the loop. But will they guard the road to Mabad Tega, I wonder?" Penrod mused aloud.
Yakub shook his head, for he had no English. Penrod switched back into Arabic.
"In God's name, brave Yakub, take us to the bitter well of the camel killer."